Alafia, Harambe listeners, you are live at the 9 o'clock hour with your show, The Liberated Zone, with your host, Baye Kemet. And tonight, I'm going to have a very special guest on the show. I had to trick this person to get on the show because I know if I had told them that they were going to be on, I would have had to hear a song and a dance. But tonight, my guest is no other than my comrade in the struggle, my soulmate, my spiritual counterpart, my better half, my right-hand woman and man, and left-hand woman and man, my wife, and my co-teacher, my co-worker, and I don't even have any other adjectives to describe. My guest and my wife is Makita Kemet. Makita, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here. I like how you tricked me too. But I'm here for you, Faye. So you're gonna have some questions for me?
Of course. I'm not gonna have you, have you on the line and have the listening people here, and we just gonna have a dialogue about, household groceries and stuff.
But, okay.
To begin the show, I just want to give, people who are listening, just a little background. Actually, I want you to, give people a little background about. Before I introduce that, I just want to say that, for people who haven't listened before, people who have been listening, over the last several weeks or so, this show has been designed to be a voice for African-centered education and educators. It is a voice for independent schools, and it has also been quite critical of all of the models that are not for the salvation and the sovereignty and the independence of our people, educationally, economically, financially, socially, what have you. And so, over the past several weeks, I've had many of the elders in the Council of Independent Black Institutions come on the show and speak. Baba Hannibal, Baba Sanika, Baba Ajay, Mama Makini, Brother Kwesi, and many others, Baba Sekou. And so tonight, I thought that it would be interesting not just to have my wife on as my wife, but as a person who grew up in the African-centered school realm back in the early 80s. And so, if you can, Makita, just tell people, who you are, your connection with African-centered education as a student, and just what impact it has had on you and your life.
Sure. Okay. Well, my mother, Mama Dino, as everybody knows her, Renee Williams, was a teacher at the African People's Action School in Trenton. And I actually was a student at African People's Action School before she became a teacher. So my mother would come into the shule and read stories to the Watoto, as this is how she told me she actually got hired. So she would come in and tell stories to the Watoto after they ate lunch. And she did it so often that she was asked to become an aide at the shule. So she was an aide for a couple of years and then was hired as a teacher, and was there for over 20 years. She was she became the vice principal of African People's Action School. I'm really not sure what year that was. But through that time, African People's Action School only went up to fifth grade. So I started at preschool and graduated from the institution. I was there with Baba Shuja was my computer teacher, Mama Makini. Mama Makini was a teacher of mine, Mama Quayle, Mama Pat, I actually didn't get my mother because I had surpassed her by the time she got into the institution. But went on to go to public school after that. Unfortunately, there were no CB institutions in the area at the time. I'm sure that if there were, my mother wouldn't have hesitated to send me to one. But I attended public school from 6th to 10th grade and then went to private school my 11th and 12th grade. So I say all that to say that the impact that the African People's Action School or having African Center education and also having the mother that I had was a powerful influence on my life, in my life, and helped me navigate through the public school system and then to that private school. I went to the Pennington School, which is far from
what we're talking about.
Which is, yes, the absolute opposite of African Center education. But if it weren't for the African People's Action School and my mother, I would not have been able to survive that experience. So, went on to Rutgers University and got my bachelor's degree. Throughout this time, even through high school and college, I had always come back to the African People's Action School, APAS. They had summer camps there. I was a counselor at the summer camp. And when I got old enough and graduated, I became a teacher's aide at APAS. And, it's a beautiful institution in that, you know, I was able to bring my daughter with me to work. It was perfect for my family. So I was a teacher's aide at APAS for, I believe, 2 years. And then I was asked to become a full-time teacher, which was a really big deal for me because I was coming behind Mama Pat to take over her class, which if anybody knows who Mama Pat is, those are some big shoes to fill. So I went through the whole training process. She trained me, and I was a teacher at the African People's Action School for three years. And after that, met my wonderful, beautiful husband, Faye Kimmich. And actually, the garden school, last year that I was there, was on the third floor of the African People's Action School. So it was sort of a divine intervention that me and my husband cross paths, shall we say. And through that divine intervention, the Garden School, of course, was already established. The following year, we decided to embark on the elementary level of Egun Omote Shule, which has been a part ever since. And so we worked together. Did I miss something? Hello,
no,
are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't think you missed anything. You can just, finish the point of
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So through, we've been working together at the Garvey School, Egun Omode Shule, for the past, are we going, I'm going on my third year, right? Is that right, Dave? Third year?
Yes, third year.
This
fourth
is the third
year.
Yeah, third or fourth year. So the school is expanding, it's growing, and it's in alignment with our mission for our family and for our community. So that's pretty much the background of me. Now, I know you wanted me to talk about the impact that the African Center education had on my life. You got to ask me a specific question, Faye.
What is the impact African Center education had on your life? No, let me stop. All right, but no. I want to know.
That's a very, I say that because that is a, I could talk for hours about that, you know, different experiences that I had, I've had in dealing with certain issues and just the kind of person that I, you know, I have become to be because of it. So that's a very broad question.
Well,
you know, that's
all. Well, but let me back up. First of all, you said that Baba Shuja was your what teacher? Your science teacher or was your computer teacher?
he was my computer teacher. Yes, we had computer class in the office of the school at the time. So it was a fun time back then. It really was. Yes,
it
was my
teacher. We were riding down Ingram Avenue today, and I said to Azigua, do you know what elementary school E.I. went to? And he was like, no. I said, she went to APAS. He said, she did? I said, but she didn't go to the one where, you know, the one you went to. And he was like, where? And I pointed to where the one you went to, and he was amazed, you know.
Yeah.
But it's funny that you said computer class in the office and those kind of things, you know, because I guess, at the time, you know, when you describe African-centered education or your experience at African People's Action School, you know, it was very interesting because I was at public school at that time. And some of the things that you all talked about, either having or not having, or the way that you had it, was always either different or didn't measure up, I guess, to public school facilities. But at the same time, they were still good enough. And if not good enough, better, you know, looking back. Does that make any sense in hindsight?
That the resources
that you had were, like, you know, good enough for you all. So, and the question I'm going to ask, just talk a little bit about, you know, I guess some of the highlights of your experience being in an African center school. You know, I know you always talk about being in this, like, sort of like bubble in this world, within a world, being in Trenton, but not being of Trenton kind of thing. But just talk about your experience at African Baptist School, some of the things that you can, you know, highlights that you remember in your early years.
Well, I remember that, again, we were in a bubble. And I didn't know at the time that I was in a bubble. So I thought that all African children grew up like this. I thought that this is how education was.
Right.
And that only when I stepped out and went to public school, I said, well, okay, it's not like that, you know. But some of the experience that I experienced, the highlights were the different activities that the teachers had us involved in really made us confident and independent children. I mean, for instance, we had a children's theater company that we traveled two different public schools putting on African-centered plays for these children. So we had, you know, it was a full production, you know. And we had a industrial arts class every morning teaching us how to use our hands. And we were actually, one of the projects, we actually made Kanaras for Kwanzaa time and were actually sell the Kanaras to the community, to whomever wanted to celebrate Kwanzaa. That was a very, you know, looking back on it, that was a very powerful experience, you know.
Right.
And we learned how to, you know, make clocks and, you know, and plant stands and, you know, which is a very, it was a wonderful experience for me. We also had an African dance company. We would travel all over and perform. So these are the kind of character-building activities I doubt that a public school, especially at that time, were allowing children, especially black children, to experience. And what'd you say?
Oh, I said most certainly not. You're right.
Right, right. So when you come out of that.
I was until I became an adult.
Right. So when I came out of, when I graduated from African People's Action School, I was a different child compared to whomever I was sitting next to in a classroom of 30 children. And I'm coming from a classroom of 10, you know.
Wow.
So the black child sitting next to me, which, let me back up, it wasn't he or she was probably the only one sitting next to me, first of all, okay? Because I went to the Pittsburgh School District, which at the time I was the only, maybe it was me and someone else, the only two or one black child in the classroom.
You went from Zimbabwe to Switzerland.
I did. I did. So that was
wow.
A culture shock. My
right.
mother can tell stories of me coming home the first day of school and just, you know, flabbergasted at the fact that I was the only one, you know?
Right.
So
it
just made me a different person. Of course, when I get to the public school, I'm getting in arguments with the history teacher, whoever the history teacher was, through all of my public school life. I always had conflict with because I knew that they were not telling me the truth.
Right.
And so my mother, you know, she had to, you know, defend me in terms of teachers sending home notes. And, you know, I do remember that part. But, you know, luckily, again, I had the mother that I had that she knew what I was going to be faced with when I left the African People's Action School. So she was ready to handle anything that I came home with and did. So those are some of the highlights. And friendships, socially, I am still close friends with a lot of the children, you know, the adults that I went to APAS with. And even if I'm not close with them, we have a certain connection that is you can't really describe it, but, you know, we're family still to this day. You know, if I see someone that I went to African People's Action School with, it's always, you know, a connection that we have and that we'll always share because it was such a unique and wonderful and uplifting experience for us to, you know, go to be able to experience ourselves and be comfortable with it and feel at home. And most children don't get to have that.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting because you began to use the word was just now, and I think that we, you know, didn't make it clear that after, I believe, 33 years or so, this year African People's Action School closed down. And I think that this might be, or aside from Mala Makini's time on the show, this is, like, really the first time that I really have spoken about, you know, African People's Action School closing. And I don't want to get too much into that on this show now, but I think that, you know, we should probably at some point maybe in the second half address some of the issues that is confronting African center schools economically, socially, and those kind of things, and just maybe we can come up with some possible solutions for people who are interested and opening a school or maintaining a shule, some of the things that they may come up against. I want to continue and talk a little bit about, you had mentioned, you know, various friends and things of that nature at African Center schools. And I always know one of the discussions that you and I always have is about, I always talk to you about the various people that I've noticed throughout my life that have attended African Center schools. You know, a lot of them, you know, I found that in their later years, in their older years, you don't find them. Again, you've also corrected me, and we've kind of came to a middle ground on this position. But I found that a lot of students who attended African Center schools early on, not all, not majority, but a lot, have in their older years strayed away from the actual practice of many of the things that they were taught in the schools, i.e. wearing African clothes or even having African, you know, aesthetics, you know, practicing African traditions, working in African independent schools or having an independent business themselves, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so, I'm going to ask you, why do you think that is? Why do you find that, you know, a lot of ex-students of African Center schools, as they get older, they begin to reject or not actually become practitioners of the information that they learn in the schools, or if you have found that at all?
Well, yes and no. But we've had a dialogue about it, and really the only solution or the only thing that I can come up with is the family. And it's not enough for a parent to send their child to an African centered school or CV school if it's not being mirrored in the home. I can really only speak for my mother, but my mother wasn't having it. You know, whatever was going on at the school, my mother was there. First of all, she was in the school. So when we came home, whatever values and morals and things like that was mirrored in my household, and she kept us in our culture constantly. You know, we were in African dance companies and you know, traveled to Africa. So my mother made sure, you know, even, you know, we were out in APAS, and once we graduated from APAS, that, yes, when I walked out the door, when I left African People's Action School and went to whatever school that I went to, that when I came home, that, you know, I left all that stuff outside, and, you know, it was about our family, and those values and morals still continued wherever I went to school, or, you know, wherever I went, you know. So it really boils down to the parents, the family. If you're just sending your child to an African centered school because you don't want them to get into fights, or, you know, you want them to get a good grade on their SAT score, you know, so they can get into a good college, then that's when you find that when they graduate, those students will not carry on the mission of the institution. So it's really a family issue, in my opinion. That's what I found.
So what do you say to those parents then that feel though they send their children to an African center school for, let's say, 4 years or 6 years or maybe even 8 years, from K to eight or even preschool to eight, and their position is, well, my child has got the foundation. I can now send them to Hunt School or Lawrenceville Prep or Pennington School or Notre Dame High School, and that my child would be okay because I want them to have real-world experiences and I want them to be able to compete with people in the real world. What is your response to that, my sister?
You put me on the spot, Vaya, okay. So,
you can't answer. I will, so.
I know you will. I know you will. All right, so what I'm saying, I'm trying to be, I don't want to say nice, but if a parent, once they reach the eighth grade, again, it really boils down to the family. And if you have a parent that has been here, who has sent their child to your institution from K to eighth grade, and by the time that child reaches the eighth grade, they still haven't gotten it, or they're saying to you, my child, you know, has had enough, then you have to ask yourself, do we really want this family in our institution? Because all of these years, they still haven't gotten it, you know? What were their intentions from the beginning? So,
not necessarily they want to come to our school. I'm just saying if that's their position in general.
What, you mean before they bring the child to the school?
No, I'm just saying, let's say if there's people in the listening audience, and that's their position, that this year they're making a decision to take their child out of sixth grade and going to send them to, I don't know, some prep school out in the woods somewhere because they feel as though their child has got the foundation. What would be your you know, response
well,
to that?
Well, I mean, I would, and you probably would also explain to them, you know, the advantages of having Africans in education. Go through that whole rigmarole. But really, my personal feeling is that I don't want to convince anyone that African education is for your family. If you need convincing, then perhaps this isn't the place for you. That's my mom's favorite line. Perhaps this isn't the place for you. I'm not big on advertising. I'm not big on trying to convince people that this is what your child or your family should do. We want families that are committed, that are confident in what it is that we are doing and will support what it is that we're doing. I'm not really big on shaky families at all. If after we have a dialogue and a true discussion about the subject, after that, if that parent still decides to take the child out, then I submit to that. And, you know, well, good luck. So I'm trying to, Baye. I'm trying to. I'll let you answer because I know you waiting to step in and bring the other side of that, of what I'm saying, aren't you?
I wouldn't say I'm waiting. I would just, you know, I agree with what you're saying. But, yeah, I do have a response myself, you know.
Yeah, and I know you.
The position is, you know, for those who are listening, especially if anybody who's interested in our institution, you all will clearly be able to hear that. It is my wife who is the one that is very hard line about admissions policies. You know, I am, you know, a little bit, I'm not liberal at all, but I'm a little bit more liberal than my wife is. But the position is that I think that I would give people the leeway only because I understand post-traumatic slave syndrome, and I understand the enamor that people have with white culture, white Western culture. And I understand that they don't know certain things. They don't know the value of African education. They don't know the value of independent, you know, businesses and owning your own and those kind of things. So, yeah, on the sleeve, they will think that, okay, they got enough education and they need to move on. What they do not understand is that when their children leaves our institutions, African-centered institutions, after 5 years or 8 years or so, if you put that on a scale of a child at 8, 9, 10 years of anything is not ready to leave the nest and go out on its own. And at a child at 8 or 9 years old does not have the faculties, the knowledge, the philosophy, the practices, the theory, all of those kind of things to combat white supremacy. You know, they don't have the faculty or all the tools to be able to know how to create a strong African family and be a leader within the community and all those, you know, all those things. So I would explain all those things to a parent, you know, again, and begin to express to them that it is not getting a good job and competing for somebody else's job is not the end all be all, and it's definitely not what we want for our children. But I don't want to get on a diatribe about that. But again, I would do a little bit more explaining and try to do a little bit more education with the family so they can understand the value that on a long-term basis, we are not here to compete with no one. We're not here to teach Spanish so our children can one day learn how to compete with Spanish kids. No, we're learning and teaching our children how to speak African languages so that we can have a strong relationship with our own people so that we can create and maintain our own sovereign nation. So that's the mentality that I would try to, like, put into parents and what have you. And then after they don't get that, then I'm falling in line with you.
Well, I said all of that. After the dialogue has been had, then they can make their own decision. I said all of that.
Not as you said.
Yes, I didn't say all of that.
Right. I know you meant it, though.
Yes. Yes.
We probably have about 3 minutes, you know. I would like, what we'll do is we'll just go ahead and take a break, you know, with the midway mark here now, and then we'll just pick up on the second half and talk a little bit more about your experience in African-centered education, both as a student and teaching, and we'll talk more about the values, the things that you've seen coming out of the Watoto that you've taught at our Shule, and just try to sum it up with some solutions we can have for many of the families who are either attending or not attending African Center schools in the second half of the show. You are listening to The Liberated Zone with your host, Baye Kemet. My guest tonight is my wife, Makita Kemet, and we look forward to you on this, building with you on the second half of the show.
Greetings, Harambe family. This is Samut A. Scott of Magical Mother. I'd like to introduce you to some friends of mine. Equity Source Home Loans, located right here in the North Brunswick, New Jersey area, have been servicing clients for more than 20 years. The office has hours Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the products they offer are conventional, FHA, VA, reverse mortgage, and assistance with investment and commercial property needs. Their number is 732 732- 821-2110 and tell them Magical Mother sent you.
Hotep, my name is Hashima, live in Harambe Studio. My show, Reading for the Soul, is on from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Tuesday night. And here, you will hear from controversial authors, seasoned authors, as well as new authors. And if you have an inspirational or transformational story that you would like to have shared all over the world, please contact me at Hashima@HarambeRadio.com. Hotep.
Peace and love. This is Samut of Magical Mother Coaching and Empowerment Services. Are you feeling stress and anxiety? Are you dealing with a life-changing circumstance or situation? Are you looking to improve your personal empowerment or your spiritual connection? At Magical Mother, we specialize in life skill and wellness coaching using the healing and spiritual arts such as meditation and yoga, qigong, and stress management techniques. You will also benefit from our publications, Mastering a Joyful Life, A Holistic Guide to Stress Management, and a full catalog of personal empowerment and inspirational CDs. Visit us on the World Wide Web at MagicalMother.com, and remember, the power is in your hands.
This is Delani Amon, thanking you for listening to Harambe Radio. Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
All right, Harambe listeners, you're back live with the show Liberated Zone with your host, Baye Kemet. And tonight, my guest is the surprised Nikita Kemet, my wife, who I had to coerce to get on the show. But she's on the show. And for the first half, we have been talking about her experience as a student at African People's Action School back in the early 80s, and her mother being a teacher there, and many of the activities and things that they had at their institution as a child, I guess, you know, her younger years. And at the end of the first half of the show, we were talking about, you know, just our comments to families who would want to have some questions about the validity or the longevity of keeping their children in an African center school. But at this point, Nikita, I want to talk a little bit about, I know, you know, of course you're an African dancer. You've been African dancing all your life. Your mother was an African dancer. Your sister dances. Your brother drums. And, you know, of course our children are coming up, you know, dancing and drumming. And I just want to talk, you know, I want you to talk to the people about the importance of teaching African dance and drum in the institution.
Okay. Well, it's a part of your culture. Of course, it's not the only part, but I would say that performing and learning African dance opened up an entire world for me. That was just the turning of the knob, really. Learning how to learning the art of African dance. I was able to travel to Africa because of African dance and learn so much more about a tradition and language through African dance. So African teaching a child movement and what those movements mean is tradition, is culture. You know, certain dances mean certain things and have a certain connection to nature, and you can start talking about nature and climate. So those are the kind of examples that I could use to just illustrate that, yes, it's a part of African culture, but it's just one part. It can open up so many more doors for you, and even on the entrepreneurship level, passing the culture on to your children, to your community, being able to be self-sufficient, you know, teaching classes. You know, I'm able to not only open up doors for children and other community members, but I'm also, at one time in my life, it actually sustained me financially.
Right.
Me and my family at one time. So African dance played a big role in, you know, me being able to navigate through life. And it's wonderful to actually see our children going through that same process. It builds character. You know, me and my sister would have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. We lived out in Pennsylvania, and every Sunday or Saturday, whichever day it was, my mother was waking us up at 6 o'clock in the morning to
right.
go to Mama Makini's house, to travel to New York or travel to Newark for rehearsals or dance classes. We would spend all day in New York or in Newark and, you know, come back late at night, having to go to school the next day. So it builds, you know, character. So I'm using all these other examples to show that it's not just about the movement. The movement was just one small part of the bigger picture, and my mother understood that. And that's why she made it be a part of who we are. So I continue to do it, and I'm making my daughter do it as my mother made me do it. I didn't have a choice, you know, because I didn't really understand just how valuable it was at the time as a child. And I shouldn't have. I was young. So my daughter's not going to have a choice either. None of our children are going to have a choice because they can't understand right now how valuable something like African dance and drum can be for their character building and their knowledge of self.
Right. And you danced that, you first started dancing at APAS?
Well, no. My mother, well, of course, my mother was a dancer first. So my mother was my first teacher. So we would actually travel. We had a little mini dance company. It was me and my sister and another child and some more adults, and we would travel. It wasn't African dance. We did modern and things like that, but when I started attending African People's Action School, that's when, you know, she was already taking African dance classes, but when she started taking it at, you know, not at APAS, but when she was a teacher there, going to different places, that's when I initially started taking African dance classes at APAS.
Right.
But
okay.
I was already sort of in the dancing mode before I went to APAS, so.
Okay. And of course, you know, at our Shule, you know, we teach African dance, drum. My children have, not just our personal children, but our students have performed at all of our Kwanzaa celebrations. And I mean, you already know, over the last few years or so, our children were, I mean, we come, what was it, about November, December?
Mm-hmm.
Our phone
mm-hmm.
rings off the hook all the way through maybe March. I mean, around March or so, we're done. We're tired that our children, our school has performed all throughout the city and the area. And in fact,
right.
the calls have already started. I got a call, you know, of course I got a call this summer about us performing
right.
in September, you know.
Right.
And so what we try to teach the children is that, you know, whatever it be, you know, of course we teach Capoeira Angola martial arts in the school. You know, and the same thing that, you know, Capoeira has also helped sustain, you know, me at some points, you know, from learning it. You know, it helped me travel to Brazil, where I spent almost a month in Brazil training Capoeira and the various, you know, teachers and mestres. And you know, so when you come back and you're able to teach this to the children, the movement is only one facet of it, you know. But,
right.
of course, there's the history of it. There's the songs
right.
you have to learn. There's the movement,
right.
the language.
Right.
It is the
right.
culture of it. It's so many parts of it that it becomes a lifestyle for you. And
right.
a lot of people don't really understand that, and they really are, you know, attracted to the
aesthetic part of it, and they don't really, you know, fully engulf themselves. They just want to be able to dance or go up down the floor and do a few moves or what have you. You know, much like myself, you know, I just want to learn, you know, Dumba so I can do it one time or Sensei, and then that's it, you know.
All right.
But it's funny how I do that with African dance, but I won't allow people to do that with capoeira, though, you know. I'll be like, no, that's not the movement. You can't do that, you know. But I'm laughing, but I'm just really talking about the importance that these various African cultural, you know, a phenomena or events or activities play in our schools.
Right.
And, you know, in addition to those, you know, African languages and other kinds of industrial arts kind of things, these are the kind of things that we are going to need if we are really, truly serious about building a sovereign nation for our people. You know, that our children have to be able to learn and relearn, re-Africanize ourselves so that we can know our own culture so then we can teach it to the next generation, you know. Right. And you already know, you know, African dance, much like capoeira, has been acculturated to the point where you look up, there's going to be white drummers, there's going to be white teachers, there's already white drummers, there's going to be white teachers, you know, and people are going to be telling our story again, you know what I'm saying, back to us, and we definitely cannot have that happen.
Right. And that's what's happening. Because, unfortunately, a lot of our people in our communities don't really understand the importance of something like African dance as a door-opening experience and a character-building experience for their children. So, you know, that's what's happening. You're seeing a lot of people that don't look like us, you know, really wanting to learn about us. And, you know, that's what we are right now. Hopefully, you know, in the years to come, we'll see some changes in that. But, you know, we can, you know, our family is doing, you know, is perpetuating the experiences that I had, and hopefully our children will do the same. They will.
Right. So what do you say, again, to the families of, I guess, people who are listening and what have you, who want to have some kind of dialogue or a conversation for the masses of children who cannot attend an African-centered charter school, I'm sorry, African center school, but many of whom who are in public schools or in charter schools and feel as though that is the best way to connect to the larger group of people, and at the same time teaching them what they consider to be an African center curriculum?
Okay, there's a two-part question. Could you give me the first part first?
What do you say to the families? I didn't know it was two parts, so I'm just gonna say it again,
okay.
But I'm gonna make it one part. What can you say to the families who cannot afford to send their, or quote unquote afford to send their children to a public, to an independent school, but have their children in public or charter schools, and feel that is the best way to reach the masses of our people through an African center way? I'm sorry.
Well, can we first address the whole not affording thing?
Okay.
I know that's not really part of your question, but
It is. That's why I said quote unquote.
You said quote unquote. Right.
Right.
I know that you've talked about this in some of your previous shows has been mentioned, but a lot of times, you know, most cases, families can afford African-centered education. Matter of fact, I had a friend who came in yesterday. My dear friend Bridget came in, and one of the first things she said out of her mouth was that she went on our website and saw how much our tuition was and was astonished at how little it was and why we didn't have more children in our institution, because it was so inexpensive. And the first thing that, you know, we get parents to come in our institution that get interviews, they talk about the tuition, or even parents that don't come into our institution and that inquire on the phone or whatever, and we tell them the tuition, and they say, okay, thank you, and hang up the phone, and we don't hear from them again, you know? So
where is their financial aid?
Right. Or is there financial, right, is there financial aid? But I know that, unfortunately, most of our people are not willing to sacrifice. It's not really even a sacrifice. It's really just putting your priorities in order. I wouldn't even call it a sacrifice. You know, most people in our communities, unfortunately, will buy a new SUV and pay for a $500 car payment rather than putting that money into their child's education.
Right.
Which,
and getting a $500,
right, and get a $200 car, buy a used car, and put the rest of that money into their child's education. Most people in our community are not willing to do that. So it's really not a sacrifice at all. Okay, but anyway, the second part of your question was, what do I say to those families that do not attend African-centered schools or in public schools and would like.
Schools.
I'm sorry?
Independent schools that don't attend independent schools but have their children in, let's say, a African-centered charter school and think that is a more efficient way.
Well, I would say to them, an African-centered charter school, in my experience, what I have seen from an African-centered charter school have a lot more constraints than an independent school would have. So some of the things that we are able to say and teach to our children, teachers that are in Ascus in a charter school would not be able to say or teach some of the things that we teach. And the second part of that is also these charter schools can hire correct me if I'm wrong, or have to hire teachers that don't look like our children. So that's another problem that I see, that you can't, a white teacher cannot teach an African child properly. It's impossible to do. And
right.
A lot of these African centered charter schools hire Europeans to teach our children, which
right.
is mind-boggling to me that you are a European trying to teach this child to be African. That doesn't make any sense to me. So I don't really know what the parents' intentions are that send their children to charter schools. I only know of one. That's our friend. I know what her intentions are. But, again, she is a strong – it's what's going on in her household. And, you know, her household is an African-centered household. So – you know, I can only speak for her will have success at the African Center Charter School because of the family that the child is coming from. But in most cases, I don't know. I can't really say what the parents' intentions are in sending these children to African Center Charter Schools. I don't know. I can't really say for sure that, their intentions are for the child to have an African-centered education.
Right.
I think that. I'm sorry. You want to say something?
No. Right.
I think that their intentions are for their child not to go to public school, and they don't want their child to get into fights, or they think that the curriculum is a little better than a public school. They're not really necessarily concerned with the African-centered part of the education. And in most cases, in these African-centered charter schools, the African-centered part is really, really not happening anyway.
Right. You know, two things I just want to amend. One, I'll go in reverse. A charter school, let's be clear, is a public school. But I know what you mean. You mean a regular public school, but it is really a regular public school. I mean, I remember when I was working at Granville, many of the children that left Trent High came to Granville. I mean, that's the same school, you know what I'm saying? And then when they got kicked out of Granville, they would go to another charter school or back to Trent High. So that's one. But the other is that charter schools don't have to hire white teachers. Charter schools are required to hire licensed teachers. And what we find more often than not is that white female teachers are licensed than black teachers, you know. But two things come to mind. I was reading, again, The Invention of Woman, And there's a section in there where she's talking about missionary school, missionary education. And really she's talking about single-sex schools and how the early missionaries came into Abeokuta, many parts of Ibadan, and many places of Nigeria, and came in and began to separate the boys and the girls in education. Not to get too far into that, but the whole notion that this educational process, you know, I lost my train of thought. But let me just talk about that. You know, I forgot the fire trying to vape, but live on Harambe Radio.
Right.
You know, the position is that these educational systems were set up. If I forgot my point, I'm making this one. These educational systems were set up mainly to create sectionalism in our families, you know, to take the men out, have the young boys learn certain educational things so they could become politicians, they could become clergy,
right.
They could become, you know, clerks and catechism and all these other kind of positions, whereas the girls were taught how to sew and do embroidery and I mean these other things, and they're preparing them to really be wives or to be counterparts to whatever the men are going to be doing. And so there's a lot of people today that try to, you know, create single-sex schools and what have you, which, again, you know, is really out of the scope of what true African-centered education is. African-centered education, as you said a few times tonight, is about the family, you know, mm-hmm. And you can't sectional or individualize one part of the family and teach to them, meaning like they have certain schools where they have child-centered, student-centered curriculums, okay? Well, that's taking out one part of the family, the child, and it is, you know, separating them from the mother, the father, the extended family, so forth and so on. And too often in these public or charter school models, we're finding that the reform systems, we're finding that all of the process that they are using does not reflect an African paradigm, especially in the African-centered paradigm. But I don't want to get too much on African-centered charter schools because that's a whole another, you know, a horse of another color. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, your teaching experiences at our institution. I have witnessed you teach time and time again in a multi-level classroom, multi-grade classroom, multi-age classroom. That in itself, many people would say, is African because that's how we started here in America, so forth and so on. That can be debated because truly, you know, African education does not require a desk and a pen and pencil and a notebook, you know. But again, you do it and we have done it over a time because there is some semblance of African culture in the multi-level educational process. So can you, you know, speak to the teachers, the aspiring teachers, homeschoolers, what have you, out here who are struggling or have some kind of fear with teaching multi-level students, I guess multi-grade students, and how you do it so gracefully?
Well, thank you. I think that, well, first, I am a baby in the teaching years. As far as I'm concerned, I am not nearly where I am, where I want to be as far as my teaching ability. Every year I get better as a teacher. I've been teaching for, I don't know however many years now, but I'm still a baby. So I'm still learning. But I do know that one of the reasons why it flows for me is because of how I'm coming through African People's Action School and being in a multi-level classroom. And my mother, being a teacher at African People's Action School and being around her and being in her classroom at times and, you know, seeing how she would teach the children and then being trained by Mama Pat, who is a master teacher, and, you know, watching her and being taught by Mama Pat, being in her classroom and then being trained by her, allows me to, I guess, have a little bit more experience than a teacher would fresh out of, I think I had a little heads up a little bit more experience as far as a college student would coming out of college or getting an education degree because of the people I was surrounded with growing up. I say all that to say that being first a student in a multi-level classroom is a different experience. We say multi-level in that there may be three levels in a classroom. You might have first, second, or third, and you might have fourth, fifth, or sixth, or whatever the case may be. Particularly this year coming, we will have first, second, and third, I believe. So being a student in that kind of environment makes you be aware of the fact that you have a younger child or you might have an older classmate surrounding you, and knowing that a teacher like myself or teachers like I had, you will be responsible for that younger child. If that younger child needs help, or you know you can ask help from the older Watoku that might be sitting next to you, that might be in the third grade and you're in the second. So it's there's a sense of community, there's a sense of sisterhood and brotherhood that is created in the classroom by the student and the teacher that allows a loving environment, a caring environment. So that tone has to be set before any teaching even begins. So I remember that feeling being in a multi-level classroom, that I felt like I was in the classroom with my sister,
right,
and that or my brother, and that if I needed help, I knew that I can all, if my teacher wasn't available, then I had someone to always help me all the time, and that to always encourage me. And a lot of our children in the public schools don't have that feeling of family, of a sense of love. So how can you then be at your best? How can you learn at your best if you're not even comfortable in your classroom?
Right. Right.
So, I know we're about to run out of time, aren't we?
Yeah, go ahead, finish.
Oh, okay. So, first, the tone has to be set in a multi-level classroom before you even begin to teach. If the child doesn't feel love in the room or love from the teacher or confidence in themselves and then the teacher, no teaching can effectively be done. So, you really can't teach that as a teacher. You really can't. There's really no manual on it, how to create this environment. It just sort of happens. And if you know, that's what your classroom experience and environment should be, that kind of feeling in the classroom.
I'm sorry, I can go on and on about it,
but I just wanted to make that clear that the child has to feel some kind of compassion and love from whoever it is that they're being taught.
Right.
Before effective learning can happen.
Well, we have to continue this conversation. You know, I think that this will be a good lead into next time we have you on. Possibly bring your mother on to talk a little bit about education, African-centered pedagogy, and, what kind of, little tricks and skills and talents and things that you all use in the classroom to get certain things apart, across.
Right.
Again, this will be a good teaching tool, a learning tool for many of the teachers out here who have to deal with these kind of issues. So, again, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. my guest tonight was, again, my wife, who was tricked on being on this show, Makita, Aisha, Rob, Kimmy. but again, I greatly appreciate you coming on. And, Liberated Zone every Monday night, 9 p.m. And I want to thank Baba Delani for allowing us this space and time to have this show. And please stay tuned for the next show at 10 p.m. And Harambe listeners, we will see you next week, Monday, 9 p.m. Ashe.
Ashe.